Thank you, Dalila, and thank you everybody for coming here today. So I'll be telling you today about an effect that we have called the piezoaxonic effect. And this is a new observable that I proposed together with my supervisor, Mina Vanataki, who's based here, and a professor in New York, Ken Van Tilburg, that we believe could be used to look for a particle, a hypothetical particle known as the QCD axion. So, brief overview of what we'll talk about today. So what is the QCD axion? Where and how do we look for the QCD axion? And how do axions interact with piezoelectric materials? So here is the shortest possible summary of where we are at the moment in particle physics. So what we know, what we've tested really well experimentally is the standard model. That's those particles on the left-hand side. And however, we know that the standard model is not the whole picture. It doesn't explain things, for example, like quantum gravity, which I'm not going to talk about here. And when we look at astrophysical observations, we see that it doesn't even explain all of the energy density in the universe. So about 68% of that energy density is in the form of dark energy. Again, not what I'm going to talk about today. However, this 27% here, which is dark matter, that's going to be the focus of my talk. And this is where the QCD axion could play a role. So you're a theorist, and you want to find out what the dark matter is made of. So what do you ask yourself? Well, is it a particle? What sort of particle is it? Do we have a model for that particle? Does that particle, this new dark matter particle, solve any existing problems in the standard model? So can you kill two birds with one stone here? Are there processes which produce this new particle, which gives it a density in the universe that matches the density that we observe? And finally, so you have this model, it gives you the dark matter density. Can we detect it? So, I mean, everything has gravitational interactions, they're quite weak. So what this normally comes, by quite weak, they're very weak. What this normally comes down to is, does this particle interact with the standard model? How big are those interactions and how can we look for them? So I'm going to go straight to the point about, does this solve any other problems in the standard model, and tell you about a problem in the standard model that's going to concern the QCD axion. And now this problem is normally known as the strong CP problem, but today we're going to call it the neutron electric dipole moment puzzle, because that is what it is. And I'm going to start by telling you an analogy. So here is a water molecule. It has two positive hydrogen atoms and a negative oxygen ion, sorry. And as you know, an electric dipole moment is a vector that's given by charges separated by some displacement. Now, in a water molecule, you have an angle of around 105 degrees, and you have a bond distance of around an angstrom. And so you can estimate the dipole moment. You would think it would be of the order of about 10 to the minus 8 centimeters times the charge of an electron. I mean, the measured value is just slightly smaller than that by a factor of a few. But we're on the mark here just with our naive dimensional analysis. Now, the next question you might ask yourself, how can we understand, I can't see the clicker, how can we understand this angle of 105 degrees? Does anybody here think it's random? No. Then does anybody have a reason for why we might have an angle of 105 degrees in water? No? No? Okay. So, I mean, of course it's not random. The way we understand it is the following. So, in a water molecule, your oxygen atom has 6 valence electrons. 2 of them form bonding pairs with hydrogen, and then the remaining 4 form these 2 negative pairs here that repel each other, and the result is that this the energetically favorable configuration for a water molecule has an angle of 105 degrees. So here we have a dynamical explanation for why we have this angle in water. Okay, now we're going to think about a neutron. And our picture of the neutron now is that it has 3 quarks, an up quark and 2 down quarks. And we're going to call the angle that separates these inside the neutron the QCD theta angle. Now, We have an idea of the distance scale in the neutron. It's the radius of the neutron. It's about 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. However, if you were to do the very exact standard model calculation, you would find that the electric dipole moment is slightly smaller than the naive dimensional analysis argument by about three orders of magnitude. So it's about 10 to the minus 16 times theta bar, your angle, times the electric charge times a centimeter. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because we've tried to measure this neutron electric dipole moment. And what we find is that the dipole moment, we have yet to measure it, but we now have an upper bound of 10 to the minus 26 times the electric charge times a centimeter. So that tells us that the QCD theta angle must be less than 1 part in 10 to the 10. So absolutely tiny. So then you're a particle physicist, and you look at this and you go, why is it so small? Do we have an answer for this? Do we have a dynamical reason? And it's stranger still, because the fact that we don't measure an electric dipole moment tells us something very physical. It tells us that both parity and time reversal symmetries are potentially preserved by the strong force. Now, that's really weird, because P and T are not good symmetries of the standard model. We already know that they're broken by the electroweak sector. So if the electroweak sector violates P and T, why doesn't QCD? So the most famous solution to this problem is the QCD axion solution. I'm going to tell you about it now. So in our standard model, we can add a term, the QCD theta term, which is related to the field strength of the gluons. And this is dimension four. It's renormalizable. It should, in principle, be there. However, the physical angle, so the angle that you measure, depends not only on this bare theta term that we've already added to the standard model, but it also depends on any potential phase of the quark mass matrix, which could also be there. And what's interesting here is that the physical angle you measure is dependent on these two completely different sources of physics, two unrelated sources of physics here, the bare theta term and the phase of the quark mass matrix. Just to go back to that line, what that's telling you is that if you're measuring a theta angle of zero, you're measuring an exact cancellation between two completely different sources of physics. Now we introduce the axion field. So it couples to the same term that depends on this gluon field strength as the bare theta term. And for historical reasons, this coupling of the axion is known as the axion decay constant. Now, what's really interesting here is that QCD will generate potential for the axion. And when the axion relaxes to the minimum of its potential, it will dynamically tune the effective theta angle that you measure to zero. So why else is the axion solution so good? We've said that it solves this neutron electric dipole moment puzzle, otherwise known as the strong CP problem. So the axion is predicted to, it could potentially be extremely light, and it's predicted to have very weak couplings with the standard model, which would mean that it could be a good dark matter candidate that's could have easily escaped detection so far. It has two main production mechanisms that would give it the abundance of dark matter that we see in the universe today. I'm not going to explain these in detail. They're just here for completion if you want to know. One of them is known as the misalignment mechanism, and another way of doing this is through decay of cosmic strings. And another interesting thing about the axion, which I'm not going to talk about today, is that there are apparently a very generic prediction of string theory. You could have many light axion-like particles, and this is known as the string axiverse. So an interesting property of very light bosonic dark matter, so not just the axion, but any bosonic particle that could be the dark matter, is that when it's very light, we actually change the way we picture this dark matter interacting. Usually we think of particles and the way we detect them like billiard balls hitting your detector. However, when you get very light and you're a boson, what happens is the de Broglie wavelength of your particle becomes very large. The wave packets start to overlap. And what becomes more appropriate, this is just a matter of convenience, is describing this dark matter in a wave-like way rather than a particle-like way. Now, the criteria for when you change your picture is roughly when the number density of the dark matter exceeds 1 over the de Broglie wavelength cubed. And if you do this for our galaxy, you find that when the mass of this bosonic dark matter falls below a random electron volt, it's more convenient to think of it like a wave. Now, some properties of this wave, it looks like a classical scalar wave, and its frequency is set by the mass of the axion. It has an amplitude that's directly proportional to the square root of the dark matter density and inversely proportional to the mass of the axion. And there's also a small spread in its frequency. So the frequency of this wave is not perfectly matched to the mass of the axion, but it has a small spread that's set by the distribution of kinetic energy of the dark matter in the galaxy. And this is about 1 part in 10 to the 6. So where should we look for the QCD axion? So the QCD axion is described by either its mass or its decay constant. They're interchangeable as they're inversely proportional to each other. And as you can see, there are potentially many orders of magnitude in which it could live. So all of this region below around 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to around 10 to the minus 21 electron volts, that's where we think the axion could be a dark matter. So above 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, we don't have a consistent production mechanism that would give you all of the dark matter. However, it could still be a solution to the strong CP problem. Nevertheless, above around 10 to the minus 2 electron volts, you have constraints from astrophysics. So this is, for example, stellar cooling. The fact that astrophysical objects that are very hot, like the sun, would produce axions, it could cause them to cool down faster. The fact that we don't see that tells us that the axion can't have a mass above around 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. Now, at the lower end, completely the other end, 10 to the minus 21 here, what you have there is that the wavelength of the axion becomes so large that this axion no longer fits in some of our smallest galaxies. And since dark matter acts a bit like the glue that holds galaxies together, we know that's not a possibility. Now, around 10 to the minus 11 electron volts here, there's a process known as black hole superradiance. I think other people will talk about that in these series of talks. I'm not going to talk about it today. And at the moment, there is one strong experimental, lab-based experimental constraint on the axion. That comes from an experiment called ADMX, which is a so-called microwave cavity. They have a very strong magnetic field, and they're converting axions into photons and trying to measure out those photons. So this dark pink region here is our parameter space that they've already constrained, and the light pink region is what they're planning to do in the near future. So today I'm going to tell you about two effects. So the piezoaxionic effect is an observable I proposed with my advisor and our collaborator, Ken. And this could potentially be used to probe the axion between around 10 to the minus 11 and 10 to the minus 7 electron volts. And then if I have time at the end, I'll briefly mention a follow-up paper we're writing about something called the ferroaxionic effect, archive 22, probably going to be 23 now. which could fill in this block of parameter space potentially between 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. So what is the piezoaxionic effect? Let me check how I'm doing time. So here is the basic idea. We're going to take a piezoelectric crystal, and we're going to use an external B field to polarize all the nuclear spins in this material. Now, assuming we live in some background axion dark matter field, it's going to cause this crystal to deform and is going to pulse with a frequency that's set by the mass of the axion. And the idea is that we want to measure these tiny deformations in our crystal. So what is a piezoelectric crystal? So a piezoelectric crystal has a structure that breaks parity symmetry. You see on the left here, not piezoelectric crystal, you have equal amounts of negative and positive charge on the left-hand side and right-hand side. So when you deform it, there's no net charge across the unit cell. Whereas in the piezoelectric crystal, your lattice structure violates parity. And when you deform it, you now have more positive charge on the left-hand side, more negative charge on the right-hand side, and you have a voltage across this crystal. The opposite's true as well. If you apply voltage to a piezoelectric crystal, it will cause it to deform. And these are very common in technology. They're used in things like microphones, watches. They've been around for over a century now. And an example of a piezoelectric crystal that you've probably heard of is quartz. So where does the axion come in? So QCD axion dark matter would induce an oscillating nuclear electric dipole moment. So you see its frequency is set by the mass of the axion, and the amplitude of this oscillating EDM would be related to the density of dark matter, the mass of the axion, and its coupling. So here we have our spinning electric dipole moment. Now, what happens at the level of a crystal is that this oscillating EDM will generate a potential that causes your unit cell to also oscillate. So here we have it when the EDM is facing one way, the EDM is facing the other way, and the crystal's deformed. This was actually really difficult to understand, super non-trivial. This is what took us like a year. So how could you look for this oscillating strain in your crystal? And I'll give you an idea of the experimental setup that we proposed. So first of all, you have to grow the right crystal. We have a few more constraints than it just being a piezoelectric crystal. We have some ideas about the right nuclei, for example, about having really good mechanical properties. Now you need to cool this down a lot. So you need to put it in something called a dilution fridge and cool it down to around a millikelvin. And the main reason you want to do that is because you want to reduce thermal noise in your crystal. And the other thing that does, we'll see in a second, is when you apply a strong external B field, the fact that it's really cool means that you can have very high nuclear spin polarization. So all of our nuclear spins are now pointing in the same direction. Our effect isn't going to average out to zero. And finally, what's going to happen is your crystal is going to pulse. Because it's a piezoelectric crystal, that deformation is going to be turned into a voltage, and we're going to measure out this tiny voltage using a very precise quantum detector known as a SQUID, which is a superconducting quantum interference device. So this very complicated plot here was the reach plot from our paper. I'm not going to go into detail about all the lines, but just to give you an idea, so this green line here is a QCD axion. And on the x-axis, we have the axion mass. On the left-hand side, we have the inverse of the axion decay constant. If you remember, I told you that there's an exact relationship for the QCD axion between the decay constant and the axion mass, which is why the QCD axion only exists on this green line. However, if we go outside of that green line, what you're potentially looking at is an axion-like particle, which is less well-motivated, but that's still unexplored parameter space. The yellow region here, all of this is parameter space that we think you could probe using the piezoaxionic effect. And then these blue and red blobs here, that's two examples of setups of crystals of different sizes. So what happens in this experiment is you're most sensitive to the resonant frequency of your crystal. So matching the resonant frequency of that crystal, which depends on its size, to the mass of the, you can match that to the mass of the axion, essentially. How are we doing for time? Okay. So a bit of history now. Piezoelectricity was discovered by the Curie brothers, without Marie Curie. and they discovered the direct piezoelectric effect, so that stress could be turned into a charge. Now, 1 year later, somebody called Gabriel Lippmann comes along and says, oh, you've missed the following. There's also a converse effect when a charge is turned into a stress. And then the Curie brothers experimentally verified this. So 1 year later, we also realized that there is a converse to the piezo axionic effect. And I'll tell you about that briefly. So this would be called the ferroaxionic effect. The reason it's called the ferroaxionic effect is because you actually need a slightly more constrained type of material. So it's a subclass of piezoelectric materials, which are known as ferroelectric materials. And so to summarize, what we noticed before was that if you have axion dark matter through the axion's coupling to gluons, it can excite vibrational modes in a crystal. Now we're going to start with our crystal. It's going to source axions. And now those axions, the setup we're proposing to detect them, is that axions will interact with nuclear spins in a sample of basically a sample used for an NMR nuclear magnetic resonance experiment. So the axions sourced by our ferroelectric crystal will interact with the spins in the sample and cause them to precess. Now, we have an idea about an experiment you could use to look for this effect. The idea is that we would have a rotating ferroelectric crystal here. It would source these axion-mediated forces that interact with nuclear spins in this sample here. And they're polarized all in the same direction with an external magnetic field. Now, when the rotation frequency of this ferroelectric source matches something known as the Larmor frequency of these spins, it's going to cause them to precess on resonance, and you get an enhanced effect. And then we'll look for the deviation of these spins in this sample, and that will cause essentially a magnetization that you can pick up again with the squid. And in this experiment, we're probing a different part of the QCD axion parameter space. So it's higher masses between around 10 to the minus 5 electron volts to 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. If you want to know where that comes from, essentially the length scale of your force is set by the mass of the axion, and that tells us we match that to how big we can build this detector, essentially. So to summarize, the QCD axion, I hope I've convinced you, is an excellent dark matter candidate. It also explains the absence of CP violation in the strong force. So QCD axion dark matter could excite vibrational modes in piezoelectric crystals via its coupling to gluons. And this could be used to probe axions in the mass range from around 10 to the minus 11 electron volts to 10 to the minus 7 electron volts. And then ferroelectric crystals could be used as a source of axion-mediated forces. And through the axion's interaction with the spins in an NMR sample, that could be used to detect axions in the mass range from around 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. Questions from the audience?
So, to scan through the parameters, build new crystals to match
them? I'll go back to that. So, yes. So, for example, this blue one, this blue thing here, it's one crystal that's 4 centimeters. It's like a putty that's about 40 centimeters long and 4 centimeters tall. And I need to correct myself. That would be the biggest one. Actually, it would be 13 crystals with heights ranging from 4 to 2 centimeters. And then we would have 13 crystals within that range. And then all of these peaks here correspond to resonant peaks of these 13 crystals. And then the way we get in between them is we actually have an external, do you know about RLC circuits? A resonance circuit. So we have some electrical components, capacitors, inductors. And what happens when we change the impedances of those electrical components, we change the electrical sensitivity of the whole setup, and that allows us to not just look right on the resonance of that crystal, but a bit around the resonance of that crystal. And then, yes, if you wanted to search across this whole region, maybe somebody will come up with an ingenious way of doing mechanical scanning, so actually changing the mechanical resonance frequency of these crystals. Maybe you could load them somehow, increase their mass somehow. Presuming we don't know how to do that, the way you would do it is you would just build a number of different setups, like a xylophone of crystals of different sizes.
So the order of magnitude in order to get the results of that experiment in terms of size, how long would it take?
Oh,
is it near future or is it?
I think we're looking at least 10 years. Nobody's building it yet.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is that most of essentially all of the bits of technology that you would need to do this already exist. So, for example, people have been looking for high-frequency gravitational waves using piezoelectric crystals and measuring out any potential strain in those crystals using a squid. And that's just short of the sensitivity we would need to do something like this. The additional issue we have is that quartz just isn't a good enough crystal for us. So I think one of the major limitations to making this a real experiment at the moment is growing the right crystal. And then, yeah, finding the people that want to work on it, want to invest the time and the money on it.
And then, so this requires the oxygen to be in that manner.
Yes, but the other experiment doesn't. Yeah, thanks. I should have mentioned that. So yes, this one does. The other effect does not, which is cool.
That's a good question. This requires the oxygen to be in that manner, as opposed to just existing in the oxygen.
So the axion is proposed, the QCD axion is proposed to solve the strong CP problem. So it's possible that it's still there, existing as the solution to the strong CP problem without actually being the dark matter. So here it needs to be, you need to have a QCD axion that makes up essentially all of the dark matter in order to see this effect. However, actually the other thing I showed you, the ferroaxionic effect, there you actually don't need the axion to be the dark matter. Even if it wasn't the dark matter, you would still see that effect.
So you have this huge mass range for the axion based on the problem. But my point is that if you find something, then you say, okay, this is a fixed mass, it means that you're fixing the decay parameter, so this is axion, and the rest are not, or you can have the axion with all these mass ranges.
The scenario of the string axiverse tells you that you might have more than one light axion. But for example, if you're expecting it to make up the totality of the dark matter, then our experiment is only potentially going to find one of these axions.
We're going to have to move on with the second seminar, so let's take a moment here.